It's Spoiler in Time, the show where we take the hard work we do on Cord Killers, trying to figure out what to watch, how to watch, and we watch it, and we talk about it. And this week, we're going to talk about Extras, Netflix series, episode 1, season 1, Chernobyl, season 1, episode 2, and the movie Toy Story 4. I'm Tom Merritt, and this is Brian Brushwood.
Thank you, Tom. I'm live on the scene here in Austin, Texas, ready to report in on this summer's movie draft.
Wasn't ready for that.
Yeah, no. I went into character. Tore your groove asunder. Hey, Tom.
Brian, are you seeing the money from Toy Story 4 still falling at this point?
I'm sorry. There's such a blizzard of this giant sucking sound of all of the money in the universe being sucked up by a re-release of Endgame. That's right. Endgame coming back, and I'm afraid it's all but decided that Frog Pants is about to run away with it with a billion-dollar draft.
You know, Avatar only made $10 million with its re-release. Now, granted, this is Endgame. What? I'm softening on my expectations. When they first announced this, I was like, that's it. Frog Pants wins. But now I'm starting, and maybe it's wishful thinking, although it's not wishful thinking for me.
Well, yeah.
But no, I'm starting to think that Team John Drecker still has a chance, especially with Toy Story 4 opening to $118 million.
Yeah, we agree this is a two-horse race right now. It's either Frog Pants or John Drecker. With $120 million on Toy Story's opening weekend, they're now at $547. Frog Pants is at 864. So let's say conservatively, there's what? $75 million in the I think they're aiming to beat Avatar. I think they'll spend however much money it takes to push it over the edge of beating Avatar and being the number one moneymaker of all time. And if they do that, I think we're looking at $100 million. So call that 964.
Toy Story 4 is probably going to make $400 million.
No. I think maybe $300 million. It released below expectations. Expectations were
120, right? Oh yeah. No, I guess they were 140. You're right.
140 were expectations, and it only did 120.
So
I think we're closer to $300 million on Toy Story. So if that's the case, we're looking at John Trekker sitting on, oh man, like 750 or so,
play this scenario out. What if The Lion King ends up making $400 million, which I know that's not likely, but it's not impossible.
No, it's entirely possible.
Million, and Frog Pants wins, and I come in second.
Well, I don't like that at all.
It's not going to
be. Why? You're coming in fifth anyway, no matter what.
No way! I'm sitting pretty in third place, I would like to believe. You're definitely going to crush us. I suddenly realized that The Lion King would have to make less than $140 million.
Sword Lizard's coming in at least third. We were going for second place until Avengers Endgame came back out.
Oh, man. No, you know what? I'm on your team. I pledge my banner to you, sir. I hope that you make the second place spot.
Yeah. We will make our best attack. Also, Elton John's got brand new songs for The Lion King. So,
why was that not in Rocket Man?
He's going to be up against himself for best music, best song at the Oscars, is my guess. That's where we are in the movie draft. Wait, we have Yesterday coming out this week, right?
Yeah, I somehow missed.
I always like to just tell what's coming out, even if, you know, it's Team Hammerson. He's at number six with $198 million, and it's his second to last. Although he has Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw, which will make a couple of million and get him possibly out of last place. We'll see.
I got to tell you, man, I don't know how I missed it, but I totally missed Yesterday as the conceit of it. I only saw the poster like the other day, and then I looked up the trailer and I'm like, what a fun idea for a movie. And then today the Rotten Tomato reviews have it as a steady 65%, which is like, ooh. Oh, doggone it. Like I love the Beatles.
It's not rotten though. 65.
No, right. It's fresh, but just barely. And I think it's, you could tell even from the trailer
that it seems a bit by the numbers. Dude bonks his head and then thinks he is the only one who knows Beatles songs. You know, okay, I get it. He wakes up at the end and learns a lesson from his dream coma thing. But I think I'll still go see it just because I love those songs so much.
Yeah, I love that idea that someone could have all the Beatles music and no one else know it and just want to share it with them.
Well, and in a weird way, I suspect that's what it feels like to a talented person, is that it comes to them so easily that it's as though they're cheating.
We wouldn't know ourselves, right? We've been told.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I could have seen a preview of Yesterday tonight, but I wouldn't be sitting here talking with you guys right now. So
you made the right choice, sir.
Exactly. All right, let's talk about making the right choice and seeing Toy Story 4, which I thought was pretty great. Where I differ in people that I've talked to about it, and I think I differ with you on this, is I just thought it was good through most of it. I never thought it was bad. I enjoyed it all the way. It was the end, especially where Woody finally is like, no, kids don't need me anymore. They'll be fine. I'm going to go do what I want to do, which is weird in Toyland, but like, just forget all that part. I like that he made that choice, and that's what elevated it for me. Otherwise, totally solid Toy Story effort here with lots of fun surprises along the way.
Yeah, so the biggest fear that I had going into it is that we're looking at brand extension. We're looking at a picture perfect ending with the third volume of the Toy Story franchise. And the worry is, what are you squeezing out more stories here? But here's the thing, is after the words happily ever after, stories continue to happen. Now the stakes are lower on them. Yes, you have the fulfilling life. You have the children, you have the dream, but at some point, the most important thing during your day is the bridge tournament. And guess what? Turns out you can make a great post-retirement movie about a bridge tournament. And in this case, it's about a bumping into an old relationship, an old flame, and Woody. I mean, it's Woody's story. It's a solo adventure for Woody. And I think I picked up pretty early on that I was like, oh my God, I mean, they're not bothering to make everybody look old, but this is a retirement story. This is a kids have moved on story, and what is there for you? And he's wrestling with the existential question of being a has-been, and it turns out that we find ourselves cheering for him to make the selfish choice. And that moment that got me so good when Buzz says she'll be all right and all of us think he's talking about Bo, and then he clarifies like, no, Bonnie, she'll be all right. Like I F-wording melted at that part. It was a delight. And Bo as Imperator Furiosa was great. I loved the fact that she lived in this crazy Mad Max world. In fact, I loved it so much that I came home and watched Mad Max Fury Road. I realized that the analogy was far from perfect, but I enjoyed sort of this post-apocalyptic hodgepodge and of her being a liberated free spirit, you know, just doing her own thing and loving every second of it. Oh my God, Tom, it turns out it was a grand adventure. There's many stories after you go to the retirement castle.
Yeah, I'm not with you on the retirement thing at all, but I agree that there are many great stories that you can tell after that picture perfect ending of Toy Story 3. And one of that was not having a story where he had to convince Bo to come back, right? Bo was never coming back. That was never even on the table. Everybody knew, like, no, Bo's not coming back. I mean, part of it is the mechanics of the world. You wouldn't have a toy just suddenly show up that you knew you gave away. It'd be a little weird. But also, it was just like, no, she's made her life. Like you said, she's independent. I feel like Toy Story 1 was, what if we did a movie from the perspective of the toys? And that was heartwarming because we all had nostalgia about toys we loved as a kid. Toy Story 2 was, what if we made another movie about the perspective of the toys? And that's why Toy Story 2 is good, but maybe not as good. And then Toy Story 3 is, yeah, but what happens when the kid doesn't need toys anymore? And it gave us this hope for the future with Bonnie at the end. That was great. It did feel like a picture-perfect ending. This time, to make it new, they said, what do the toys do when they're outdated? Which we hadn't really touched on as much. We touched on here and there in the franchise, but there are definitely toys that get passed along, and then the kids are like, yeah, I don't want to play with that. That's old. I don't want that. That's not my generation. And that's Woody. You know, he's kept in the closet most of the time because she's like, no, Jesse's way cooler. If I'm going to play with an old toy, that's what I'm going to play with. And so what happens to that? We're back to the premise of the first story, which I guess brings me into your perspective on retirement a little bit. But it's not willing retirement. It's more about like making a choice about whether you want to stick with something when you're no longer useful or appreciated for it.
Yeah, they did. Now, having said this, my praise is just about universal for this whole thing. There was a little bit more world breakage in this one. Is it Kristen Schaal voicing the Triceratops?
Yeah.
Okay. There was an awful lot of toys just talking to humans. In this compared to the previous ones.
Talking to humans?
Yes. She's pretending to be the GPS, talking out loud to a human being, telling him to turn right and left. At some point, Buzz Lightyear says, "Your backpack is in this building over there."
Right. Like, he doesn't just press his button. He actually says it.
Right. Yeah. And then on top of that, Key and Peele, like they're fake outs always, but they play with the idea of what if they just straight up started kicking the butts of humans and so on.
Well, the fake outs I could live with.
Sure.
It's not world breaking because it's their imagination. But you're right. The other two, they are heard speaking, which we have been taught up till now is just not possible.
Correct. It was world breaking in the way that that Finding Dory was world breaking. The idea of, seven armed octopus driving a car was a little bit like, OK, this is not even in the same universe as Finding Nemo.
And you're right. Like these world breaking, I'd forgotten they even happened until you reminded me. They bothered me that little, but they are there.
Yeah, they took me along for the ride. Was Little Bo Peep not in Toy Story 3 at all?
No, I don't think so. I don't think she's been in since 1.
Wow. Man, there are some great gags in there. The fact that she's made of porcelain and like that, first of all, the gag where he yanks off the arm and then she freaks out and then like, gotcha. But also because of the porcelain, when Billy Goat and Gruff fall down and you see a leg chip off, like I alone in the theater was like, oh, full on gasped at the ramifications. It was a very soft villain in this one.
You can correctly criticize it as a soft villain, but it's also a complex villain, and I liked that she wasn't just a villainous toy. She had motivation for doing the bad thing she wanted, so we didn't get a pure villain, but I almost preferred that because I understood what she wanted, and it gave Woody a chance to make a sacrifice, which I thought was a good point.
Yeah, but also she definitely kidnapped someone and traded it for one of Woody's organs, I don't know, which makes her redemption arc complicated. Because I'm like, you definitely held a friend at gunpoint and said, give me your kidney. And he gave you a kidney. And I don't know that I feel good about you using that kidney. Yeah, turns out that the kidney wasn't even...
Although later you found out you still needed it. Because the guy who gave you the kidney pointed out to you that you could still use the kidney that he gave you.
But that's the other thing, is that's not... The kidney wasn't even a deciding factor on whether or not fell in love. The girl already needed a friend before she said anything. It was like, oh, I guess you can also talk. I guess that's cool. I'd love you anyway.
I think the talking had a little more impact than maybe you're giving it credit for. But you're right. She saw the friend first before she pulled the cord.
Yeah. Loved Canadian Evil Knievel. Key and Peele's bits were great. Yes, we Canada. It was great. It was a delight. Please let this be the last one.
Risk it again, right? That's my feeling. Like, I guess you could make a Toy Story 5 that would pull this trick off again, but I'd rather you didn't try.
It was a little bit odd that they set Buzz Lightyear up as such a simpleton. He seemed to have really evolved and come into his own in the previous movies. And all of a sudden he's so dumb as to misunderstand what an inner voice is. And yes, that was a fun running gag, but it was kind of beneath him or whatever. Fun fact. You know what I found out is that the Don Rickles stuff, the Mr. Potato Head stuff, they didn't want to have anyone else read lines for them. So they scoured, you know, over the years, there have been so many Toy Story video games, so many expanded straight to video stuff and shorts that they just found enough content to put all of Don Rickles' voice and all that.
I noticed that when every time Mr. Potato Head talked, I'm like, okay, that line could have easily existed. Like they definitely wrote to that, which is fine. Good. I'm actually glad about that.
Yeah. Let me give you an alternate path here. Toy Story 1 is about a leader who has not earned the title, and he's not a very good leader. Woody is a bad leader who has been given kingship by divine right, and as a result is not very good. He's challenged and has to grow and learn to share power and become a good leader. Toy Story 2 is what happens when for the toys, it's a rescue mission. For Toy Story 2, it's like, okay, what if you found out that you belong to an even higher power? You were a valuable, you weren't just a toy, you were a valuable collectible. And Woody has to wrestle with his questions of loyalty to Andy, his duty of his position versus a birthright. So previously he thought, oh, well, I'm his favorite toy because that's my birthright. But now he has to wrestle with like, well, this is an even bigger birthright, but which do I choose, my loyalty to Andy or my birthright? And then Toy Story 3 is like, what happens when none of that matters and your constituency outgrows you, which I think was interesting. And so in that regard, Chapter 4, this retirement phase, is what happens when all of that is behind you and you're just a merchant on the street and you literally used to be king. And how do you wrestle with all that? And do you not crave the life of a Ronin or something? And so in that regard, if you think of it all through the Woody lens, these really are four chapters of a life cycle. And
I like the
and
Ronin
it does
thing.
Work.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anything else about Toy Story 4?
No, I liked it. I liked the laser eyes.
Yeah, the laser eyes. All the Key and Peele stuff was fantastic. And even right down to the post-credit stuff, like you say, the laser eyes. All right, let's talk about Chernobyl, episode 2, where our main character finally gets listened to and gives them the best of the worst solutions that they can do, and then is told that he did it wrong.
I loved episode 2 so much more than episode 1. Everything that I felt like I was missing from episode 1 in terms of context and the severity of what they were up against, all the stuff. Now keep in mind, I understand there's no way to give me what I wanted in episode 1 in episode 1. But it all shows up here in episode 2. From beginning to end, the politics, the denial, that moment when he blows up and says, in like, we can all stay here. It's like, yes, we're staying here. Yes, and we'll be dead in 5 years. That moment sucker punches that bureaucrat, and you feel it. Oh,
and
it's
like,
so good.
That choice was already made.
Right.
You didn't get to make it for yourself, but it was made and it's over. Do you want to do it for other people?
Right. And you could tell that lands. Meanwhile, quick side note. Tom, I swear, you should not have mocked me for my love of the X-ray feature on Amazon, because the scientist who is, you know, 400 kilometers away and is picking up the...
I don't remember mocking you, but carry on.
I think you said something to the...
I think you may have built this up in your mind.
You said something
bit.
To the tune of like, oh, because you can't be bothered to IMDb it. I understand it's so difficult to do it.
Yeah,
but,
I probably said something sarcastic like that. Sounds like me.
The... So in this case, what happened was the female scientist who picks up the radioactive material and figures out that it's Chernobyl. I was like, wait, is that the girl from
Better Call Saul?
No, from Equilibrium is where I first saw her. She was a sense offender in Equilibrium, and I'm like, oh, there's no X-ray or anything. And ultimately, what I had to do is type in IMDb Chernobyl Equilibrium, and it came up with her name. But anyway, the point is, X-ray is great on Amazon.
You open the IMDb app. That's a lot easier.
Cannot litigate this again.
You got to figure out who the person is. You got to look at a bunch of mugshots to identify your actor.
I don't want to. I saw a tiger and I threw red meat at it. I apologize.
So, point is, she's great. And I love the whole interplay where she realizes that she's not going to get through to the party leader. So she gives the iodine tablets to the secretary,
That's another gut punch moment where she's like, "You just need to take these. I can't save everybody else, but I at least could give you these iodine tablets, right?"
Right. Well, but also it's a shrewd maneuver because yes, I do think she was trying to help her out, but also I think she was making inroads so that she could make clear that the party's not going to handle this correctly,
You may have on that, because she does that in a similar way when she calls her friend to be like, "Hello, is my friend there? Are they visiting? Oh no, they don't want visitors. Okay, yeah, was good.
Silas and Boris are here."
It shows how things get done by working around the system, even in something as monolithic as communist Russia.
Yeah, Emily Watson is the actor's name. She's fantastic.
And the behind the episode featurette after the episode, like Jackie points out, that she is a fictional character for the story. She is a stand-in for a number of scientists who played that role in the Chernobyl incident.
Also, the helicopter hitting a thing and then spiraling down in there, that did happen, but that was months afterwards as they continued to try to contain stuff. It was an unrelated, or I guess, I mean, obviously a related accident, but it wasn't, you know, in the moment for the death.
It wasn't that first try. Yeah.
Yeah.
The featurette is very interesting because the creator, I think, talks about like how you have to compress the historical reality with the realities of making television, you know? So you have to make multiple people into one.
Right, because let's say he made it sound like there were like a dozen or more people who he compressed into Emily Watson's character. And you could see where if you were true to history, you'd have to introduce every one of those characters. And you could, if you could just have one character do all those things, then we get the same impact, but you don't have to spend all that time trying to introduce us and bond us to all these different folks.
Exactly.
But now I'd be curious for you guys, was episode two better or worse for you guys?
Oh, better. Yeah, definitely better. And I didn't have as many problems with episode one, but I looked at episode one and said, okay, that was prologue. That was setup. That was telling us all the things we need to know to tell the story. And this felt like they started to tell the story.
Yeah.
And so all those pieces that we got introduced to in episode one, they just got it all out of the way rather than introducing us to to the firefighter's wife later. They just like, here, meet all the people, see all the things that happened at the beginning. Now let's start telling the story of Chernobyl.
It escalates from episode one in a way. Like, I think episode one, a lot of what they do there is to set up like, listen, you know about Chernobyl, you know what you're watching is bad. And so I think they leave a lot of stuff unsaid. I think that's why you watch the investigator kill himself at the beginning, because if you know anything about it, you probably know that this guy dies anyway. And so that's not going to be some big buildup. We're here in episode two. I think we talked about this off air, but like, this is when you get understanding of how the scale of the tragedy, right? Of all the nuclear radiation, of being around for thousands of years, the lava, the explosions that are capable.
I like the fact that they've figured out new stakes to introduce with the water needing to, you know, because once that hits the water, that's going to be a 4 megaton explosion.
And they explain it well. They explain all the science really well. I think it helps that there are people around them that don't know science.
Right. They're explaining it like, pretend I'm an average HBO viewer and explain this to me.
There's moments where they're like, explain to me how nuclear fission works. Great. Now I don't need you because I have exposed this to the audience. Yeah,
I am really enjoying watching him break down the barriers of the party line and basically say, you know, begin to understand like, oh my God, like party be damned. We have a job to do here.
Yeah.
I think one of the greatest moments is they don't make a big deal, which they could have. They don't make a big dramatic moment of when the rest of the world finds out, right? They don't all sigh and throw papers and get angry. They just, it was so very, I think, accurate to the way bureaucracies work, where they just saw that and went like, well, now we that we can't cover that up anymore. Where do we go next?
I think the line
so
was
mechanical.
There's that pause and they were like, everybody knows, you know. You know what it felt like?
And then it cuts right to the news broadcast.
Yeah, I don't know if you watched. Did you ever see First Man about Neil Armstrong going to the moon?
No, I did.
One of the things I loved about it is that they deliberately didn't show a bunch of the jingoistic, patriotic, rah-rah, you know, nation worlds all around. It was like his experiences. I mean, I don't know. I was in this tin can, just everything shaking, and it was really loud. And that's what we experienced as the audience. And likewise, to those bureaucrats, it's like, well, I don't know. I didn't see all the broadcasts. I just know that we're screwed and everybody knows, you know,
so we're covering this up, right? Wait, who knows? Well, okay. We're not covering that up anymore. What do we, Here we go. Yeah.
There was something terrible about the bureaucracy of those buses coming in and knowing like that moment where they did us a favor of not having any dialogue, but you see a soldier take a puppy away from a child and you just are left to imagine all the lies.
There's actually a whole book called The Dogs of Chernobyl about talks about why they did that, the people who were upset about it, and the pets that survived years later. And then when they would go back to Chernobyl and they would find these dogs and descendants of dogs that were left behind. It's a crazy story.
I really deeply adored how much was left just to implication, just left for your own mind to write those vignettes.
Even, I guess this also ties into the very last sequence as you follow the three divers as they go into the water tanks. I was initially kind of like, oh, I guess part of me was like, well, is this supposed to be ambiguous of whether they are actually successful or not? But then there's also the entire helicopter sequence right before it where it's like they're going to keep throwing everything that they need to put this through because finally they understand
guys die and don't do the job, then they'll send in more guys, right?
Yeah.
Do you think it was clearly indicated that they just went in and their lights went out and they died?
I don't know. I guess we'll have to find out.
It felt to me like because I'm pretty sure, and again, this is me remembering a half-remembered article. Mm-hmm. I believe they were successful, and that's what they're fictionalizing.
Sure.
And I think they're just trying to find a punch-out, whoa, moment for the end of episode two, which I'm a little bit bummed about because I don't think that was necessarily needed. But
the lights might have really gone out though.
Yeah,
and they might be. And then tomorrow, next episode, we find out that they succeeded somehow.
Yeah.
In the dark.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anything else about Chernobyl?
Yeah.
The greatest thing since Tetris.
It's good. I like the detective story so far. I wonder how many more characters we're going to meet. It meant something to me in that party first kind of way when that, I don't know, general or whoever says, well, then I'll drive the truck myself. And he goes in there and finds out that it's like, you know, 15,000 rungeons or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
It reminded me that in this sideways universe, there are noble men who are true believers in what they're a part of. And I felt like that guy was one of them.
Yeah. I hope we get more of that because the Soviet Union was a complex society and there were Mary Watsons and there were scientists and there were self-sacrificing believers and there were propagandic jingoistic believers. We've seen all of them. So far. So I hope that continues.
That was a great moment when you have the two sycophants, the two hyenas who are just like, oh, we already have a list of people to accuse of whatever. And don't worry. And then he's able to say, why would you say the core would explode? And then, you know, we just spent this whole scene looking at what appears to be him not really caring or not really listening. And then instead, you know, for him to turn around and say, well, then how come I saw graphite on the top of the roof or whatever? That was the first crack that it's like, okay, maybe this guy's all right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he's always been all right. He's just no nonsense. And no nonsense sometimes means denying things because you're like, yeah, people say a lot of dumb stuff.
Right.
And so I'm just going to blow it off until I can't ignore it anymore. And the graphite became a thing he couldn't ignore anymore. He's like, nope, I think that one's probably true. So I'm going with that.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, let's talk about extras. Episode one.
Tom, I need to know. Look, we were on the Ricky Gervais Highway, and I understand we were supposed to already have taken an exit to Larry Sanders Boulevard, and I understand that I'm the one who saw the shiny signs for extras, but and now we're on
the extras turnpike. I know it's going to add a lot of hours to our journey here, and I don't normally live on the air suddenly propose a drastic change of course, but now that we're on our way, how are you
feeling? Actually, I would argue that you drastically changing our course live on air is not that surprising.
Okay, but I try not to. No. but now that we're here.
However, thankfully, you have not taken us over a cliff. Extras was delightful. It was Ricky Gervais is all the good things of David Brent, the awkwardness, the sort of lack of self-awareness here and there, but with redeeming qualities, with like actual concern for his friend, with actual like a sense of ambition that is, you know, maybe out of proportion in what he thinks he can get away with, but not out of proportion in what's realistic. Like all of the crazy things, like him trying to talk to the guy at the club or him trying to get a line by buttering up the other guy. Those are at least realistic. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah. It's a stretch, but it might work. And his friend is just also totally realistic in that, you know, she's there because this is glamorous and fun, but also, you know, wants to meet somebody. And maybe that somebody's the producer. And it's not immediately like, and I can also help my career, right? Even though that's probably in her mind. Of course it is. So it's just so much more complex, so much more realistic in the characters, and yet hilarious at the same time.
Yeah.
In fact, the paper character is Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller is the you know, ridiculous version of Ben Stiller, which is also hilarious.
Yeah, which I don't think this is a much of a spoiler if I tell you that that's a format you're going to see repeated throughout the whole first season. Is there's going to be a guest star who's like legit famous. They're going to play essentially a parody of themselves. Uh-huh. It's going to be delightful and surprising. And along, like each episode opens with what looks like the scene of an epic movie and then turns out to be the set that they're working on. And hijinks ensue. I just remember liking it a lot. But now that I've had my palate reset from The Office UK, oh, my God, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. It's so good.
No, I agree. This show's what I know Ricky Gervais is capable of, because I've seen him in other things. And he has grown, and Stephen Merchant, who works on Extras, also grown well past what they did in The Office UK, which makes me think that The Office UK, we're probably unfairly judging it by 2019 standards, given that the fact that there was nothing like it before it was done.
Yes. And also it's of its time and times change.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Stuff. Yeah. Man, the, yeah, I don't have too many details to say on it outside of I think the first episode of Extras might stand up to one of the best episodes of The Office. And I mean, would that be fair to say?
I think it would be fair to say. I'd have to go back and review all the Office UK episodes, but I certainly was smiling a lot and enjoying Extras episode one quite a bit.
Yeah.
I laughed out loud many times during this episode.
It was one of those that Bonnie came up and was like, "What are you watching?" It was when Ben Stiller was melting down trying to validate himself about who he kissed and whose butt he touched and stuff and how it still counts. Like that was kind of satisfying to see Ricky Gervais take the piss out of Ben Stiller. That was fun.
Yeah, no, this is good. I'm enjoying it. What are we're talking about? It's not a long diversion anyway, right?
Yeah, no, it's a, I don't know, short 12, seasons. I think there's
12 episodes.
Yeah.
And a Christmas special. Oh, a Christmas special.
Cool.
Sorry, Bryce. All right, that's it for this episode of Spoiler in Time. Thanks for joining us. Supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/cordkillers is where you go to directly support the show. There's no other way this show is supported than you giving us a buck. Why not give us one right now? patreon.com/cordkillers. We'll spoil you again next week if you do.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.